I committed myself a couple of weeks ago to preaching some sermons on questions like, does God exist? If God exists, what's He like? Is Jesus the Son of God? Is the Bible the Word of God? And just really very fundamental issues like that. And so tonight this morning we want to talk about the first of those questions. Does God exist? Is there a God? And later on, maybe next week, we'll talk about if there is a God, what is He like? Well, as you know, the Bible doesn't contain an elaborate, sophisticated, sustained argument for the existence of God. We might find that in some books like a systematic theology or something like that. In fact, you can go to the library and you can find lots of entire books on that very question. Some very small books and some rather large books on the question, does God exist? But the Bible doesn't contain a very long, sophisticated, sustained argument on the existence of God. Its first sentence is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it simply assumes God's existence. Now, there are arguments, maybe not fashioned in the form of a logical argument like we might find in other books, but there are arguments in the Bible for the existence of God, and we might note some of those this morning. But for the most part, the Bible just says God did this, or God said that, or there is a God. In fact, the Bible is full of references to God. The number of references to God in the Bible numbers in the thousands, thousands of references to God. God alone, the word God alone is found over 4,000 times in the King James Bible. And that doesn't take into account words like Jehovah or the Lord or Father or words like that. Statistics indicate that most people believe in God. In fact, the overwhelming majority of people believe in God of some kind. Figures I saw said that 92% of Americans believe in God, a God of some kind. Now, that doesn't mean that they believe in God as He's described in the Bible. They might be Buddhists or Hindus, or they may not be religious at all, but they believe in a God of some kind, 92%. But there is a small and rather vocal group of people who don't believe in God, who are atheists. Now, the number of people who claim not to believe in God is greater, let's say, between the ages of 18 and 35. And so people in that age group, there are more people in that age group who deny the existence of God. But even in that age group, the vast majority of people believe in a God of some kind. And so our question this morning is there evidence that God exists? Is the faith of believers irrational and blind? I believe in God. Well, you know, you're superstitious. You believe in things that are just irrational, and your faith is a blind faith. Is that true that for believers in God, their faith is irrational or unreasonable? Or is there actually evidence for the existence of God? We believe that there is good reason to believe that God exists, that a supreme, infinite, spiritual, personal being exists out there. Doesn't just exist in our mind. It doesn't just exist when we're thinking about Him, that He exists whether we're thinking about Him or not, that He objectively exists and not just as a figment of our imagination. And what we want to do this morning is provide some evidence for the existence of God. And as usually is the case, there are some preliminary observations. First of all, there will always be unbelievers. Some people will never be convinced, even when presented with evidence sufficient to convince most people. There will always be some people who deny the existence of God. For example, some people are unconvinced the Holocaust actually took place, even though there's adequate evidence to convince open-minded, sort of neutral observers. When you look at the evidence is sufficient to convince most people that the Holocaust actually did take place. There are always going to be some people who deny that it took place, in spite of the fact that there's eyewitness testimony. There are people living today who survived the Nazi concentration camps. There are written accounts, some of those coming from the Nazis themselves. There are photographs. The camps still exist, and we can go over there and we can do research and investigate them. There are incidental factors that suggest the Holocaust took place. For example, prior to this particular event, the population of the Jews in Europe was X. After this event took place, the population of Jews in Europe was much less. What explains that? Well, a reasonable explanation would be the Holocaust actually did take place. But still, some people refuse to be convinced. And I remember one time I met a guy and he denied it. He said that the Holocaust was a hoax perpetrated by the Jews. Now, this is sort of an elaborate hoax that's been perpetrated by them in order to gain sympathy for their causes, to raise money, and so forth. And so some people just won't be convinced, regardless of the amount of evidence that is provided. It's not that there's no evidence for God. It's not that the evidence for God is unclear. Look at Romans chapter 1. Paul speaks to that point in a few things that he says in that place. Romans chapter 1, verse 19. He says, that which is known about God is evident within them, for God has made it evident to them. And so, information about God is plain, because God has made it plain. All right? God has made it evident to them. He goes on, since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. And so there are things, not only that God exists, but there are certain attributes about God that are clearly seen by the things that have been made. We can go down a little bit further. Look, for example, verse 28. Just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind. And so throughout this particular passage, verse 21, even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God. And so he's talking about the Gentile world who rejected a knowledge of the true God in favor of worshiping idols. And he says, now there's plenty of evidence for God because God made Himself plain. He made the evidence plain. It's simply that they chose not to recognize Him and acknowledge His existence. And they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, for idols, and they chose rather to serve the idols rather than the true God. And so, God has made things plain for us. The evidence is there. And if we'll open our mind to it, we can see the evidence and be convinced that God exists. Why is it that people refuse to believe that God exists? Well, I'll borrow the words of Paul from 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4 where he says, well, the God of this world has blinded their minds. It's not that there's no evidence. It's not that the evidence is not clear, but the God of this world has blinded the minds of those who refuse to believe. Paul says that the world in its wisdom did not know God. And sometimes people value human reason over clear evidence that God exists. And so the world, through its wisdom, which it values more highly than God's wisdom, cannot come to know God. But if we're open to the revelation God has provided, we can come to the correct conclusion. And I'll suggest that there is a correct conclusion. There is a right conclusion to the question, does God exist? God cannot exist for some people and not exist for other people. Either exists or He doesn't exist. There's truth on that question. There is a correct answer, and we're going to try to find it today, at least suggest some evidence that will provide the answer. Another preliminary observation is that the evidence is not direct. We don't see God with our eyes. We don't hear Him with our ears. We can't hold Him in our hands and feel Him like I'm holding this water bottle and feeling it in my hands. God cannot be measured or weighed or subjected to physical analysis. He doesn't emit sound or smell or color. It's not that, well, God is blue. Anytime you see blue, you see God. No, God doesn't have a color. The evidence for God is not direct like that. We can't see Him or measure Him or handle Him or hear Him or those kinds of things. The evidence is indirect or circumstantial. And people might think, well, that's sort of weak circumstantial evidence. Well, Kevin's not here today. I think he's preaching somewhere. But Kevin would tell you that most cases, most legal cases, are settled on circumstantial evidence. The evidence, yes, is circumstantial, but the evidence is so strong, it leads us to the right conclusion, the correct conclusion. Another observation might be that our inability to adequately defend the existence of God in the minds of some does not mean that God does not exist. Just because I may not be able to prove to your satisfaction that God exists, that doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. Just because I can't prove it. It just means that I haven't been able to prove it. It merely means that we haven't offered convincing evidence. You ever known of a court case where the defendant was guilty? He knew he was guilty. The jury knew he was guilty. The lawyers knew he was guilty. We all knew he was guilty, but it just couldn't be proven. And so the inability of the prosecutor to prove it by a certain standard doesn't mean he wasn't guilty. It just means he couldn't prove it. And so my inability to provide a convincing argument, that doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. Just means, it just is, I suppose, highlights my limitations and my inability. Proving the existence of God poses a problem for us. You see, we're limited, finite human beings with many flaws. And we're trying to explain the existence and ways of the infinite, unlimited, flawless God. And so our efforts are going to be weak at best. And so that poses a problem. How can we, limited as we are, finite as we are, weak and flawed, how can we ever approach the infinite, you know, flawless, limitless God? Well, that's one of the problems that we have to wrestle with. The nature of the proof of God's existence, again, is not such that all people are going to be convinced. There are always going to be some who refuse to be convinced. It's not that the evidence is not there. It's simply that sometimes they have another agenda that doesn't allow for them to believe in the existence of God. Or what do we mean when we say that God exists? Well, God can be described in many different ways. The Bible describes God in one way, but it's different from God as described by Judaism or Islam. It's certainly different from the way God is described by pantheists who believe that the sum total of the universe is God, or a Hindu that believes in many gods. Oprah recently said, she was talking to Diana Nyad, who swam from Cuba to Miami or to Key West. In the interview, Diana Nyad was saying that she was an atheist. She didn't believe in God, and she can stand before nature, and she can be just struck by the awe and the wonder and the magnificence and splendor of nature. And Oprah said, well, I think if you believe in the awe and the wonder and the mystery, that's what God is. It's not a bearded guy in the sky. So there's another description of God. God is the wonder and the mystery. Well, is that what we mean when we say that God exists? Well, our interest is not merely in showing that a God of some kind exists. It's in showing that God, the supreme being, who is spirit, personal, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal, and free, that he exists, that he is a person. It's not just a force out there. He is a person. He is powerful, all powerful. He can do whatever can be done. He is omniscient. He can know whatever can be known. He is free. He can do this. He can decide to do this instead of that. He has intellect. He has the power to choose. He is eternal. He exists at all times. He is omniscient. He is in every place at all times. It's not that part of him is here and part of him is out there. No, all of him is here and all of him is out there. If you can even speak in those terms. And so that's what our interest is in, describing that God exists. All right, let's talk a little bit about some arguments for the existence of God. There are lots of them. Many arguments for the existence of God. People have been debating the issue for thousands of years. There have been proposed arguments in favor for the existence of God. The unbeliever has countered that with his arguments. The believer countered that with more arguments. And so this has been going on for a long, long time. There are arguments from personal intuition. All of us have a sense of God. There are arguments from history. Inexplicable things have happened in the past, and the only way to explain them is the existence of a God who's active in those events. There are arguments from science and nature. There are non-religious philosophical arguments. There are arguments from theology. There are all kinds of arguments for the existence of God. Some of them, of course, are better than others. A man named Richard Swinburne, who is the Naloth Professor of Philosophy of Religion at Oxford University, at least at one time he was, in his book on the existence of God, lists six different kinds of arguments. And what we want to do today is just focus on four. The first one is called the cosmological argument. It raises the question, why does the universe exist instead of not existing? Well, why is it here instead of absent? Well, the idea is that everything that occurs in the universe has a cause. And so everything has a cause. I exist for a reason. There's a cause that produced my existence. This building has been caused, it has been brought into existence. Everything that we experience in this universe has a cause. But there must be an original cause for it all. That we cannot have just an infinite number of causes all the way back through eternity. So there must be a first cause. And that first cause that brought all things into existence is God. That's the most reasonable and satisfying explanation as to why the universe exists and does not exist. We can see something of this argument in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4, where the writer says, every house is built by someone, and he who made all things is God. Every house is made by someone, he who made all things is God. And so everything is here for a reason, because it's been built by someone, so to speak. And the one who built everything, the first cause, the first builder, is God. There's what's called the teleological argument. It's from a Greek word, telos, which means end or purpose. And that suggests or is built upon the idea that the universe has order and harmony and design. That things, as you look at the universe and look at the various systems in the universe, that there's order and design and purpose to it all. And so this, because built on that idea or referring to the idea of purpose from the Greek word telos, this is called the teleological argument. The idea is that the complexity and design that we see in the universe suggests an intelligent designer. We could illustrate it in this way. If you were part of a search party looking for someone who was marooned on a deserted island, and so you're out there, you're looking for this person, that you believe that they might be marooned on this particular desert island, and you see in your search for this person, you see some footprints. And they're walking from the water along the beach through the sand up into the trees. You say, hey, there's somebody here. look at that. Look at the order. Look at the design. Look at those are footprints leading from the water to the trees. There's somebody here. Or if you're looking for that person and you saw some branches, here's a branch that's between two trees, and you see some other branches at an angle, as if this was some sort of little lean-to or some sort of protection from the design. That's a very simple design, but if you saw that, you'd say, there's somebody here, and it might be the person I'm looking for. And so you see that design, and that implies that an intelligent designer is responsible. Or if you saw, for example, some rocks. You saw a pile of rocks, but they were just a pile of rocks. Might not think very much about that. But if you saw six or eight rocks and they were placed in the shape of an arrow, it might just be a few rocks, but placed in the shape of an arrow, that's a very simple design. But if you saw that pointing in a certain direction, say, hey, somebody's been here. And so design suggests an intelligent designer. If you came upon an island and you saw a group of rocks like this, or like this. That's pretty simple design. Some rectangular stones. They're really pretty big stones. And they're arranged more or less in a circle. There are some stones on top of other stones. Somebody did that. And that's a simple design. It's not really very complicated. But everybody understands somebody is responsible for that. Now, we may not understand who it is, and we don't necessarily know why they did things the way they did them here, but some person, some intelligent being, has designed that. And if you were to find this on a deserted island, you'd know somebody has been here. Somebody's been here. And this is a very complicated design here, isn't it? Now, this is a representation of human beings. These are not human beings. It's a representation of human beings. An actual human being is much more complicated than this. Much more complicated than this. And if we can look at this and reach the conclusion that an intelligent designer is responsible for this, surely we can look at ourselves. Much more complicated than this. Our own body and the universe. And the logical conclusion is some intelligent designer is responsible. If we would think that about this sculpture, well, we surely would think that about us, you know, the universe, our being, ultimately more, infinitely more complicated. A modern example of a teleological argument is made by a man named Richard Behe. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. He is the professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. His argument is from what he's called, let me back up a little bit, irreducible complexity. It suggests, and here's his argument, it suggests that there are phenomena, natural phenomena, that occur as a result of a process, as a result of a series of events. For example, the clotting of blood. If we cut ourselves, eventually the bleeding stops and it forms a scab. Now, the clotting of blood, according to Dr. Behe, occurs as a result of a series of events. A, B, C, D produce the clotting of blood. But all of those things have to occur. A, B, C doesn't result in the clotting of blood. All of those, A, B, C, D, every step in that process has to occur in order for the clotting of blood to take place. And that's very important that our blood clots. If our blood doesn't clot, if you're on a blood thinner, for example, and your blood doesn't clot, you know, it would be dangerous for you to sustain a deep wound. And you could bleed to death. So in order for blood to clot, A, B, C, and D all have to occur. They all have to occur in that order. A by itself, step A by itself, doesn't really produce anything beneficial. Step B by itself doesn't produce anything beneficial. A, B, C, D all have to occur. They all have to occur in that order. It can't be A, C, B, D, or D, C, B, A, or A, D, C, B. It all has to occur. A, step B, step C, step D produces the clotting of blood. In fact, in some of these kinds of phenomena, maybe not necessarily the clotting of blood, but in some of these kinds of phenomena, if you don't have everything occurring in the right sequence, in the right measure, at the right time, not only do you not get something beneficial, harm is actually done. And so, according to that argument, you know, that's very complex design. It simply cannot happen through a process of evolution. You can't have A and B, because sometimes when A and B occur without C coming in at the right time, you've got an explosion on your hands. And so that's a very complex process, and it couldn't just happen by accident. It just can't happen by accident, according to Dr. Behe's argument. You can read about that in a book called Darwin's Black Box. He's much more qualified to discuss it than I am. And so if you're interested in that, I suggest you get that book and read it. But we can read something about like this argument in the statement, Psalm 139, verse 14. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I mean, you look at the body, you look at the processes and the systems in the body, and wow, it just couldn't happen by accident. Well, then there is also what's called the ontological argument. It's a philosophical argument developed by a bishop named Anselm in the 11th century. The argument goes like this, that God is the being than which none greater can be thought of. Now, some of these things can make your head spin. I'll admit that. I've been reading about these things over the last couple of weeks, and I feel like my head's in a spin sometimes. But this argument goes like this. God is that being than which none other, none greater can be thought of. That being must exist. If it doesn't exist, well then he is not that being than which none greater can be thought of, because to exist is better than to not exist, is greater than to not exist. And so the argument goes, this being must exist. Not only does this being exist now, he cannot not exist, either now or eternally. Otherwise, it would not be a being than which nothing greater can be thought of. We're not going to spend very much time on that argument. Some people think it's the greatest one. It's the best. Some people think it's the worst one. And we're going to acknowledge that it's out there. If you're interested in it, I can get you some material. You can read it. I wonder if God's name doesn't approach this. Whom shall I say sent me? I am. I am has sent you. That's what you need to tell them. All right, well, we're going to go on. There's what's called the moral argument. That is that human beings, regardless of their culture, regardless of where they live or when they live, all share a sense of right and wrong. C.S. Lewis makes this argument, the abolition of man or mere Christianity. And this shared sense of right and wrong is remarkably similar in detail. Everybody believes it's wrong to murder, to kill other human beings indiscriminately. Everybody understands that. It's wrong to commit adultery. Stealing is wrong. On the other hand, helping the helpless is good. Rescuing the endangered is right. It's right to do. So how do you explain this? Everybody has this shared sense of right and wrong, this shared sense of morality, and it's all very similar. Now, there may be some differences from culture to culture, but it's all very similar, remarkably similar. How do you explain it? Well, we explain it in that there is a creator, God, who has a moral sense, a sense of right and wrong. This conduct is right, this conduct is wrong, and he's created us this way. That's why we all share a common sense of right and wrong. Now, Paul refers to this in Romans chapter 2, where he says in verse 14, when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively or by nature the things of the law, these not having the law are a law unto themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness in their thoughts, alternately accusing or else defending them. And so, those who don't have the revealed law of God, the law of Moses, the Gentile world, they still have a sense of right and wrong. Because God has put, in the words of the preacher in the book of Ecclesiastes, God has put eternity in their heart. He's created us that way. He's created us with a sense that God exists and this sense of morality of right and wrong. Well, those are four classical arguments for the existence of God. And they've been put forward through the centuries. They've been answered by unbelievers, and responses to those answers have been given. And I suppose there's weight to be given to all of these arguments. They're all good in some way, and it may very well be that when you take all of them together, the cumulative effect of these is convincing that God exists. Yes, there is a God. He exists. Here's one line of evidence, here's another, and so on. Well, you know me, you know that I'm not a philosopher. I'm certainly not a scientist. I'm not really much of a theologian even. I wouldn't claim to be a theologian. I'm kind of just a Bible teacher. That's what I would try to be, just a Bible teacher. I think even in the Bible we can find evidence for the existence of God. The 19th Psalm says, as we saw a few weeks ago, the heavens are telling the glory of God. The expanse is declaring the work of His hands. Mark, if you'll turn down the lights a little bit, I'll show these pictures again. I'm getting a lot of mileage out of these pictures. Just let you look at these and let that speak for itself. The heavens are declaring the glory of God. Well, let me hook this up. All right. I think the real power of these pictures comes because they remind us of things that we have seen ourselves. It's not just in the pictures themselves. by themselves, but it's in our own experience of these things. I'm not going to comment a lot about this, but just remember that passage. The heavens are declaring the glory of God. And the evidence of God is clear through the things that He's made. So just think about this. There's the northern lights. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. Day unto day utters speech, night unto night shows knowledge. There's no language, no speech, their voice isn't heard. But you see the sunrise in the morning, and then day unto day, night unto night. Wasn't it Louis Armstrong that talked about the dark sacred night in one of his songs? There's the sun. There's the sun setting. And there's the night. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. The way that song goes, you can see that. Hey, there's a picture of Saturn recently taken from space. It's just overwhelming, isn't it? The heavens declare the glory of God. There's Earth taken from the moon. Now, again, if you're not convinced of that, I'm going to show you another set of slides. And just think about these. All right, so what do you think? Does God exist? Yeah. The evidence is there. It's overwhelming. There is a God. Just a couple of observations in closing. Let's not allow a small but vocal minority to intimidate us into silence. Yes, God exists. Stand for it. Don't be ashamed of it. Speak up. I'm a believer. I believe that God exists. Our first step toward being right with God is believing that He is, and that He is the rewarder of those who seek Him. Do you want to be right with God? You must believe that He is. And you must believe that He will reward you if you seek Him. So think about that today. If you're not a child of God, you have an opportunity to become a child of God by believing that He is, that He sent His Son into the world, that He died on the cross to atone for your sin, by putting your faith in Him through repentance, confession, by being baptized in Jesus' name. You can be a child of the God that we've talked about today and enjoy all the blessings that He has to give. If you're a Christian but not right with Him because of sin in your life, repent of that and confess it, and He'll forgive, and we can be right with Him once again. If we can help you in some way today, we invite you to come as we stand together and sing.